Welcome to Grief is My Side Hustle. I am your host, as always, the very enthusiastic Megan Reardon Jarvis, because I finally finished the book just in time to interview its author, Raina Cohen, the author of The Other Significant Others, is here with us today. Thank you so much for being here.
I was going to say, I'm so happy to be here, but we're going to talk about grief. So
I know. You know. It's perverse to say anytime anyone's calling me, I'm like, it's so good to hear from you, but also bad. Also sad, very complicated. I loved this book. How are you feeling being here to talk about this book that's about to find its way out onto all the shelves and things?
I'm in a place of a lot of gratitude right now that people have started to read the book. I've had one major podcast at this point come out that has had a lot of people learn about the book and have gotten feedback from some of the people in the book who have finally gotten copies and gotten to read about themselves. And I think I spent more time working on this book than I spent in college. It's a big, big project. And also there's so much anticipation and not knowing how would the people I write about receive it? How would anybody care? And feeling like, okay, I'm getting some sense that people care. And it's a matter of, can I keep up with the reactions or the ways that I want to share the book with the world? And that's a really good problem to have. If you asked me a month and a half ago, I might have been a little bit like, I don't know that anyone's going to like ever learn about this book. I don't know that anyone is going to care. So it's changed.
I love that answer. And I also think it's reflective of the content that's in the book. So let's dig into it a little bit. I'm going to ask you the same question I ask everybody when they come on out of the gate. Like, what brings you into the world of grief and loss?
I report on relationships, on really deep relationships. And I don't think that you can look fully at people's closest relationships without also looking at the loss that's involved in them. That can be the loss in terms of somebody dying and having to deal with that permanent loss. And then there are other ways that relationships can end or erode or transition that involve a lot of pain. And it's something that I explore in this book and that I'm interested in, kind of the full spectrum of experiences and relationships.
Yeah. Part of what I love about this book, and I really want to encourage everyone to go out and get it, get your hands on it, because I'm excited to hear how people react to it, because there is a core memoir component to it, but also you're bringing in the collective experience of the world around relationships. And one piece, just the title of the book tells you what you're going to head into, is the acknowledgement of something that's gone unacknowledged for a really long time, which is that we construct our lives alongside other people who are general contractors in our lives. And they are not always, as you beautifully open, your best friend, also your husband or wife. It's often these deep friendships that don't necessarily get, I don't know, I kept reading and thinking, God, isn't it the Inuits who have 700 words for snow or something? That this might be one of those things where we need more language. And luckily you gave us lots and lots of pages. So can you tell us, like, how did you decide to write about this? And this is very all encompassing, so that maybe isn't even a fair question, but can you tell us how the book began to grow for you?
It began in a personal place with a friendship with someone who I use the pseudonym for M. And the two of us met now 5-6 years ago, not far away from where either of us are living now. As we
saw that, I was like, oh, I know where you are.
So the book started in a really personal place for me, which is a friendship that I fell into several years ago when I moved to DC, which is essentially where both you and I call home right now. Mm-hmm. And I experienced feelings that I did not know you could have in a friendship. Infatuation, a desire to constantly be around my friend. There was even like elements of romance that felt like they were a part of it and how affectionate we were, but it didn't have a sexual component. And it also didn't really feel like best friend was a sufficient description for how close we were and how intimately our lives had become bound together quite quickly, where I would stop at her home on the way to the office, just get some oatmeal in the morning, or we would sit and quietly read together and would learn so much about each other's lives and the people in them and move through the world much more like partners than maybe even what we think of as best friends. So I became interested in, this is such an important relationship in my life. Why isn't there a name for it? People's responses are sometimes, were generally like positive and curious and yearning in some cases, like that they wanted something similar. So I'm like, there's something beautiful here. Why aren't we told that we could have it? And who else has these sorts of relationships, and can we learn something from them? That's the questions kept going from there. But that was the initial spark that this particular personal friendship ended up creating for me.
Yeah. Somewhere in the book, you quote Esther Perel. I can't remember where it is. It might be early, but you quote her as describing like the dangers of having all your emotional needs in one place with a partner. Mm-hmm. And that the fantasy that we sometimes have is that I'm going to meet this one person and they're going to fill me up and I won't need any other people. It'll just be the two of us in a boat. And you challenge that. Yeah.
Yeah, I'm just like, because I don't know, I'm surrounded by a lot of young children and I'm just treating spouses like baby formula. You can get everything in one.
All your macronutrients in one.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, and that would be convenient if it were, or it would seem to be convenient and efficient, but it that mentality, I think, really can harm people's relationships because they end up disappointed that their spouse can't fulfill that, and that instead of maybe questioning the expectations, one, that maybe they're leaning too much on their spouse, romantic partner, and the other, that they're not taking enough kind of time and care for other types of relationships in their lives, like friendships. So instead of examining those kinds of assumptions and behaviors, they might just think that their relationship isn't working, or that they have to settle for less contentment because it's worth the cost, and not that maybe we need to reconfigure how we set up our lives and what we expect of the people that we're closest to.
Yeah. Also, somewhere in the book, you talk about, you reference the loneliness epidemic that the Surgeon General, it may even be more than once. And what occurred to me when I was reading is like having a partner does not necessarily mean that you're not profoundly lonely. As a trauma therapist who's worked, seen the intimate sides of people that are experiencing relationships in the way that are real, there is something really seductive about the way that you describe. It's such a good meet cute. It's what it sounds like meeting a boyfriend in a bar, the way that you describe meeting M. And so I'm curious about, are there things that you can talk about in terms of understanding friendships as you have interviewed people in this book? Were there surprises for you? Were there things that felt like, wow, that really matches up to my personal experience? Or boy, that really challenges my personal experience?
One thing that came up was my sense of what it was that I was interested in, like what the kind of friendship was that I was interested in. So I mentioned that there was this kind of, or it continues to be this sort of romantic valence to the way that Em and I interact, in that we will wrap our arms around each other, are very sweet and celebratory of the friendship. And I knew about this history of what are called romantic friendships. So if you look in 17th, 18th, 19th centuries, they're both among men and women, there are these very effusive, intimate same-sex friendships. And so what I initially thought I was doing, and what I, like my project, like different project files for the book, are like the RF project, romantic friendship project.
Yeah.
So I thought that I was trying to really revive this model from an earlier time. And something that kept coming up was I would tell people about what I was trying to write about, and was looking for people with these friendships because, like, they are socially invisible. It's like hard to find people. And a response I would get is, I know somebody like this, or I have something like this, but it's more like a sibling relationship. I wouldn't say it has anything romantic involved. Even the term romantic friendship was alienating to them. And so I was like, yeah, that's different than what I'm looking at. That's different. And then I changed my mind because I was like, oh, the thing that matters, like the factor here that I'm interested in, is not the emotional expressiveness in the friendship, but the commitment. So that what felt like the glue. And that's where I shifted to, okay, people I'm looking at friends who are functioning as partners, as life partners who are caring for each other and committed, rather than I'm looking for people who have this kind of passionate feeling in their friendship. And I think, you know, it makes sense when you think about the kind of full spectrum of experiences people have in romantic relationships, where yes, there are romantic relationships that are extraordinarily passionate and infatuated. And then there are also very companionate romantic relationships.
Yeah.
And we
yeah.
consider all of those legitimate romantic relationships. There might be some judgment or whatever here and there, but these all belong to the same category. That was a surprise for me, because I came in looking for something specific and realized that I needed to actually adjust the aperture a little bit and change the category that I was most interested in, because the partnership aspect, I think, led to more interesting questions. And I do engage with the romance aspect in one of the chapters of the book in particular, but that wasn't actually the whole thing that I wanted to explore.
So one of the things I love about reading particularly memoirs that like you're given the gift of then bouncing that off of your own personal experience. So one of the things when I was reading, again, I think it might be early in the book, but when you're talking about meeting M and like wanting to see her and wanting to, I really related to that. Like, and I think you use the word crush, which is a word that I love. Oh, I just have a crush on that person. Meaning I'm thinking about them. I'm wondering about them. I want to be close to them. Mm-hmm. And that in my experience, both personally, but also it's like a joke amongst therapists, because that's my day job, that like it's intolerable to have your client fall newly blissfully in love, because the energy around it is so protective. The person is, you're obsessed with them and they're perfect and everything they do is perfect. And so there isn't a lot of like therapy work to do with somebody who is blissfully in love, unless the attachment is making them feel scared and in danger and all those things. And so one of the things that I was thinking about is probably lots of us, if you captured us in that early moment, that again, maybe is intolerable in therapy, that early moment of when I meet this person and they're beginning to make what will become a very significant imprint on my life, that has a kind of tenor and a tone to it that has all that high energy of falling in love. But I have had a best friend since I was 11. And which again, I just was reading the book with that in mind and that friendship in mind and thinking about who we have been to each other and how I'm partnered, she is not partnered, and what that role means and what those relationships mean. And what your book really highlighted for me is maybe that actually just gets marginalized. Like that relationship that I have with my best friend is maybe more private and misunderstood than my marriage in some ways. Does that make sense?
Absolutely. These relationships are not given their due. And that's so much what the point is of the book, of showing people, one, that friendship can be this. But I think something that's interesting is like a lot of people maybe feel that these feelings, but don't know that anybody else does. So they don't discuss it. It feels bizarre. And I could pull up the book and find the statistics here, but in the section that's, you know, that's about, can you feel like romance and passion in the absence of sexual attraction? The answer is yes. The numbers of people who have experienced that are so high. I think it was something like there was a survey of adults that was like, I don't know, 70 something percent had said that they have had infatuation without sexual attraction. And then there were basically two studies, one maybe 50 years ago and one very recently, and the numbers were very close. And then there's research on children, who prepubescent children, who they don't have a sexual drive, but what they will say, those exact things that you said, that there's somebody in their life that they just like always want to be around, always want to know about. One person that I interviewed for the book, or they and their friends call it the treadmill. You're just like kind of like always want to learn more. And so it just, it, it, one of, something I'm hoping that happens with the book is that these experiences that feel really unusual and somewhat isolating, we can all start to acknowledge that they exist. And if we acknowledge them, there's potential for connection there, because you're saying like, I'm so excited about you. I think you're like a great person who I want to get to know. It doesn't mean poof, everybody's going to have a life-defining friendship, but it does mean that there might be more ways to show people that we are interested in getting to know them and like fortify relationships and move them along to a closer place faster.
That's a great answer, because one of the questions I had written down for you was like, so why does it matter if we were to acknowledge these friendships, if we were to put better language or discuss it or just understand that there are people who exist with maybe multiple influences that are positive in their life outside of marriage? Like, one thing I was thinking about as a therapist is you often hear, and maybe even in a cliched way, like the influence that a mother has inside a marriage, right? Somebody's mother is a third, is how they talk about it in therapy. And I was really thinking about that, like, that you're not describing it as a third, meaning like a problem, that your relationship with your romantic partner is somehow under threat because of this. You're more talking about it as one of those things that actually exists in life that supports our life. But I'm curious, what would, if we were to acknowledge it, if we were to take this book and say, okay, we're going to put some language around this, we're going to have discussions about it, people, we're going to go to book club, and I want to hear about your person who would, or your people who would qualify in this group. What do you see as like the benefit of that? Does that make sense?
I think that we can start to narrow the gap between people's desires and realities. That so many people crave more connection. Loneliness epidemic is as you brought up, but also data on the number of close friends people have shows that the number of close friends people have in the US has declined a lot in just a matter of a few decades. And not only that, but people are not satisfied with the number of close friends. It would be one thing if people had made a concerted decision to narrow their social worlds, but that does not seem to be the case. I think recognizing that we can find deeper ties and friendships can allow people to make it happen, make something happen that they might not have been able to utter before. I also do think that it improves the other relationships in our lives, including romantic relationships. I do recount in the book some experiences where a romantic partner just is not having it, that he or she is not the number one priority in the person's life and their romantic partner's life. And those people, sometimes those lead to the end, that can lead to the end of a friendship or the sublimation of a friendship. But the kind of richer stories that I tell are ones where the romantic partner is so glad the friend is there. And that there is this kind of simple math that I think people do, which is if you can just stuff everything in one person, then that's more efficient, that's easier, and that anything that you're not doing for your romantic partner is you're taking away from them. It's zero sum. And what these friendships show is that there's actually a multiplier effect, that having more close relationships can demand more work, but it also means you will have more support and more different types of people to lean on. And I've seen in my own life, just like somebody was asking me yesterday, how does it work to maintain, like, how does my sort of friend circle of friends work, that I have a, both intimate friendships and like kind of a lot of other people around. And it's like when you have these webs that are knitted together, then you end up having more support. So I'm looking in the book primarily at these sort of partnership level friendships, and then looking at those maybe alongside a romantic relationship, but it also can work in other ways where it's maybe like a group of people. And but no matter what the situation is, like having more than one person create this kind of support that enriches all of the relationships and makes them less fragile.
It's such a, that's such a beautiful answer. And it's what it's making me think about, which I, again, I threaded this and it, you touch on this in different aspects in the book, but this is one of those things where it's like, oh, it's my podcast. So I'm just going to ask you like my personal question about this, because I'm really, since my mom died in 2019 and my friendships shifted tremendously on account of that loss. And one of the things that I have been thinking a lot about is when you have, as I do, a person who's been in my life since I was 11, and I have a sister who I'm really close with. What I show to the outside world is what I'm capable of, right? Like I have a marriage that I like and people that I'm close with. And I'm curious about the pain of people who want that kind of closeness or want to get in to that kind of closeness, and there isn't necessarily room. Can you talk a little bit about that?
So, as in, like people who maybe want a friendship, but then the person's life is too full.
Yeah, what I was thinking about with M is, God, you guys just crashed into each other at this perfect moment developmentally, perfect moment in time. And then I think there is the possibility of edges of people who aren't interviewed and aren't, who were like, I actually would have loved that kind of attention, but I didn't know she was capable of it. I didn't know she was looking for it. And I think fundamentally, there's a reason why M is your mate in that moment and someone else isn't. And so I'm just curious about that, because I think there's this whole, actually The Atlantic, you write for The Atlantic, had this article that was, I don't think it was yours, that was about like, why do we use the word best friend? That we shouldn't use that word best friend, that actually it's selective and that it's predictive and that it excludes other people. And I had such a strong reaction to it because I was like, but I do have a best friend. I'm sorry if that hurts your feelings, but it's not about your feelings. It's the same way I have a husband and the same way I have a child and the same way I have a dog. I do. So I'm curious about what's the responsibility, or what do we do with the energy of the people around us?
I was thinking about a version of this last night where I was talking to a straight man who is looking for more deep friendships with men, which he's really struggled to find. Yeah, it seems like he's really put in the work. And I was saying like, oh, I'm gonna try to find some people for you. And I was going through my head and I was like, the really like great male friend candidates here are like, have very full lives. Yeah. And it felt a little sad to think about that. This, here is somebody who could be a potentially wonderful friend. And maybe I'm wrong about it. Maybe it's, you should still connect people and something can form, but there, just because you want something doesn't mean that it's going to happen. And I do feel tremendously lucky that I met M at this point where we just had a lot of space in our lives. Neither of us had been in DC for all that long. I was in a long distance relationship. She was not in a romantic relationship at the time. We didn't have these really full friend circles the way that we have after years of living in the same places. Yeah, there's a different world. And I actually remember being very similarly smitten about somebody that I met and realizing that she was just like not that reliable, and that I was like, yes, the desire is there, the excitement, but practically it's not going to happen. So I've experienced that, and there was a real disappointment because I had been so excited. And I don't know, that is a form of loss, but it's so important to try for these things, that my hope is that people can not be so afraid of rejection that they don't even make the attempt. Easier said than done.
It's so tricky maybe the older you get, maybe there are phases. I think there are certain, think about college a lot and like how people go to dining hall. And so that concept of doing an activity alongside somebody else that allows you to talk to them, that way that is structured really is to support connection and friendships. And there are places in other countries that are putting that together for the elderly, like dorm living. If I'm looking at Instagram and I see a group of 12 women who went to Nashville for the weekend and they're wearing like matching t-shirts, I have two reactions. One is I feel really jealous. I don't have a group of 12 women. I don't have matching t-shirts. Nobody invited me to Nashville. So I feel jealous. And then I have this, oh, and also groups of women are not a thing that I know how to do very well. What I do is what you do with, which is you find someone, you connect in a corner, and then you hope it's going to work out. You hope you have enough time to get coffee. And the longer my life has been in trajectory, what I've discovered is there are seasons where that's easier. And that there are some elements where, oh, that woman I liked from that thing, her kid is on my kid's soccer team. Great. That means we're going to at least have an hour and a half of conversation on the sidelines, or we could on Saturday morning. Can you talk about what do we have to do? What do we do? What is your friend doing when we have to take ourselves out into the world to pursue these friendships?
I do think the kind of pairing activities up is a really important way to become closer to people. Pretty much right before this call, I had a run with a friend. We do a weekly run that we've called Rave and Run. Partly, it's really just like therapy while running, mutual therapy. And I just know so much more about her life because of that ritual that we have, which is also, there's something compelling for both of us, not just to see each other, but also that we want to have this form of exercise in our lives. And I think this particular friend is very good at setting up these sorts of things.
Yeah.
Because I think one way that people find that they maybe meet somebody but can't escalate the relationship to be closer is that they don't have easy ways to continually see each other. So if you have something that's recurring and maybe there's an activity that it's built around, it just creates this structure. I think that we need somewhat larger changes here around how we set up our environment. That it is, so I live with housemates, I live with friends of mine, and not because I have to, but because I want to. And I live in a 5-minute radius of several of my closest friends and walking distance of many more. And it changes life to live that way versus people that I know who have moved farther away for different sorts of reasons. And the easier it is to run into people or to make last minute plans, the easier it is to cultivate these sorts of relationships. And friends of mine are now making a decision about where to move, and they have decided that they're going to try to move within a few houses of one of their closest friends. That will be transformative for their experience. And I think that, I guess your question is about like, how do you make friends in the first place? But then I think there's also a question of like, how do you make friendships that aren't superficial? And one is to really be in the thick of each other's lives. And that I think is like a bigger project of how do we make decisions about where we're going to live and how we're going to live and what we prioritize.
That is a gorgeous answer. And I think one that people probably minimize, right? Like you get a job offer in San Diego and you're like, it's a great job offer. And for a lot of what I hear from folks, it's about how's that going to impact maybe their spouse or their parents or their children. But often I'm the person saying, and what about how you live your life socially and your network of people? And often it's I make friends easily. I'm good at making friends. I, without an understanding that like when you move to a new place as an adult, it is a little bit like dating some of the time. If you're looking for the kind of connection that your book really focuses on, which is the way that we deeply influence each other and support each other and care about each other.
Yeah, I'm not saying people shouldn't move and shouldn't make these do things that create friction in their social lives, but it isn't perplexing that it is not a kind of feel like, that it doesn't feel like more of a sacrifice to people, that it's, oh, I'll just pick up and make new friends, and which sort of treats previous friendships as if they're fungible or disposable or replaceable. And I'm somebody who loves like meeting new people, and I get the thrill of making new friends, but I think it's possible to hold that I can handle this, and also it is giving up something, and that I will, it would be a good idea for me to have conversations with my friends about how this will affect our relationship and how maybe we want to keep in touch or how often I'm going to go back. And so it's not that you have to not make these decisions, but that recognizing what you're giving up can maybe cause you to one, mourn, that really move through the emotional experience of it, and also maybe change your behavior in terms of making sure that you're still nurturing those relationships.
I want to ask about, there are two friends that you use as an illustration in the beginning of the book that are Andrew and, is it Tali? Andrew and Tali.
Holy.
Holy. And one of the things I was struck by, so they have a third friend and that friend does not survive. And which I think, maybe you don't outright say it, but they cling to each other in the friendship. So first they're a trio and then they're a duo. And one of the things I was struck by was like the ease with which they seem to prioritize their friendship. And so when I was reading that, I was thinking about, and again, this is in the book and other places, but I was thinking about sometimes you know that this is a core relationship, that this is someone who has the potential to be an influence in your life, and they are not as aware of how valuable the friendship is, and maybe even minimizing it. And maybe, so you're willing to, I don't know, move to Chicago to be near them, and they're not acknowledging what exists between the two of you. Did you encounter that? Can you talk a little bit about that? Is that a problem that people were reporting to you when you were interviewing?
There were mismatches that people experienced. And by virtue of the people that I was writing about, for the most part, they figured this out and they stabilized. But I can, in one case with these, another pair of men named Art and Nick, Nick was very wrapped up in his relationships with girlfriends and would basically disappear and then would come back crying on Art's shoulder and want him to be around. And Art was pretty fed up about that. And they had really frank conversations, and Nick changed his behavior and treated the relationship as a more significant one. One little detail that I think about is that Nick would just come extraordinarily late to whatever Art had planned, Which I think in some people are just late, but it also indicates the thoughtlessness that you don't really matter. And so he started setting an alarm on his watch to make sure that he would show up on time. So that is a case where Nick went from seeing the friendship as just like something he could turn to when he wanted to and neglect when he didn't care enough, to treating this friend as somebody who not only he was going to be on time to see, but he has as a real partner in life. So there, what was the other? Yeah, and there's a similar story that's not so much about lack of somebody being absent, but two people trying to figure out, like, how committed are we?
Yeah.
And that's a whole other layer of question to ask in a culture where there's only kind of one type of relationship that you're expected to commit to, but these friends like really cared about each other and were trying to negotiate for themselves. Is this the relationship that I want to prioritize even above a romantic relationship? And that has, they also had their own sort of evolution there.
Yeah. One of the things I was thinking when I was reading is that I have friends that built a company together very early in their college life, and that company is very successful. And part of what in their work is the friendship that they built, and that they built that intentionally, and that they butt heads about their production and where they want to go in their company. And they butt heads about their friendship and how they, and each person ends up having to set a priority. Again, like any relationship, you're saying whether or not you want to be in it or how much you want to be in it based on how you reflect and behave in those instances. But part of what your book does or did for me was really make me thoughtful about the invisibility of these things that are actually right in front of us. The decisions that people are making to prioritize how to not be lonely, right? And I say this a lot, like we focus sometimes, I think, on the wrong conversation. Not that I'm suggesting that the Surgeon General shouldn't have done a report on loneliness, because it those statistics and that all of that matters. But I am really curious to hear from people who have figured out how to not be lonely, particularly in reflection to all the disconnect that we had during COVID. For people who weren't lonely during that time, what were they doing? How were they managing to do that? Was there anything as you were spending this time with these people, thinking about your own relationships, were there takeaways for you about how to run a deeply connected, well-supported life?
I mean, there are a bunch of things that I learned from the people that I talked to. One thing that might be surprising, given that these friendships are, they resemble romantic relationships in the level of commitment, is that again and again that I would find that there was a third friend who was either just as close or very something like that, or that the dyad was nested in a larger group of friends. And so there's a way that these friendships both look a lot like romantic relationships, but also don't replicate this thing that we were talking about of whatever, expecting to get all your macronutrients, as you put it, from one person. So that was interesting to me that there could have both this kind of friendship and have it exist in this larger circle. And that seemed to be like extremely common and helpful. Just the level of intentionality that people brought and the willingness to have hard conversations was very striking to me, because I think a lot of people approach friendship where you leave things unsaid. And if something is difficult, then you maybe like leave it behind or treat it as radioactive rather than walk into it and try to sort it out in the way that spouses can be avoidant. But I think there's a general expectation that there's going to be some disagreement that happens and you negotiate and maybe you get outside help, but in friendship that it should just all be easy. Otherwise it's not worth it. And for these friends, there's so much that's beautiful, but also there in any kind of close relationship, there's going to be things that you don't agree about and there's complexity. So I think not necessarily seeing any sign of disagreement or difficulty as a reason that the friendship isn't working, but instead that you can get on better terms with each other and make the kind of changes that I was talking about earlier with Nick was not a very good friend and he turned into a much better friend. Other people have changed their minds about things, and that there's also a kind of willingness to grow and be prodded by somebody that you really, a friend that you really trust.
Yeah. As you think about your life going forward and the way that you want to live, are there lessons for you or even you in your M relationship or relationships with roommates and housemates that you, as you start to look down the line, that you think is maybe different having done the research and explored this book than how you might have assumed it when you were, I don't know, 16 years old with the kinds of friendships we have as a teenager?
I think the parenting piece is really, was very mind expanding for me. So in the book, I profile two women who are friends, one of whom decided to have a child on her own, and the other just became really intimately involved in the child's life, and to the point where she was really acting as a parent. And in this particular case, it's was so important because all kids require a lot, but this boy a lot has complex disabilities and medical issues. And as this woman, Linda, said, that he needed two or all the or as many parents as he could have.
Yes.
And what comes up in their story is, one, how many parents do we think people should have? Because eventually what happens is not only do these two women, Linda and Natasha, become parents, but Linda ends up in a romantic relationship and her partner is also then functions as a third parent. And so there's a question of like, why do we max out at two parents? It's a question decide that maybe two parents is the perfect number, but I don't think we're asking the question. And then the other piece is like, who should parent together? And that there is an expectation it's just so assumed, like we wouldn't even ask the question. And it's also baked into the law that people who are having children together should have a conjugal or sexual relationship, or at least should have had in the past, even if they're not there now because they've split up or something. And the idea that two or more people might come together and have a really deep platonic relationship and decide that we are so compatible when it comes to kind of everything that's related to running a household or raising kids or whatever, like that does not cross people's minds. And I'm working on a story right now about ostensibly working on a story when the book comes down, but about parents who raise their children with or very close by friends. Yeah. And how that affects their friendships. And I was talking to the director of this really great legal organization called the Chosen Family Law Center. And they've advised a lot of people who want to be like platonic or advise people who are trying to make different decisions around parenting, including a lot of people who will come and be like, I just met this person, this like, new romantic partner. We don't know each other that well, but we want to have a baby. And I just want to make sure that we're setting things up well. And this lawyer will advise them like, this is like a really high risk for divorce. If you really want to have a kid, are there other people in your life, really trusting relationships? And they will often come back and be like, yes, this other thing is, I can maybe keep the romantic relationship going, but it's too risky to start up a partnership. And I have this like friend of 30 years or whatever it is. And I'm at the age where a lot of people are having children or are at the point where they're like scared that they won't be able to have children if they don't find a partner very soon.
Yeah.
And I think the knowing that it is possible to basically disaggregate the romance/sex piece from parenting, which is often disaggregated anyway. Like,
of course, because it's a misnomer to say it exists to begin with.
But also that children kill, at least temporarily, right, drain a lot of that from partnerships. That it could be really a viable way for people to have families that they don't think of right now. And it doesn't mean that everyone is going to be perfect in the way that like every relationship, romantic relationship is not perfect, but that there's an option that people did not even realize that could be potentially stronger than the only one that we're told is allowed.
I found that chapter where you really begin to unfold, hey, look at how the laws are drawn. Look at the bias that's in here. Does it even make any sense? I just found that really provocative. Like, I have thought so much about even movies that we have found so compelling that end up being the story of three men that are friends that end up taking care of a baby, or that there is a understanding that there could and is goodness around having a more expansive definition of family.
Full House.
Exactly. That's what I mean. There are really popular TV shows and movies that are just predicated on the idea that, and both of the ones that I'm talking about, like a group of men who have an affiliation to each other, some maybe are related, that everybody gets value out of that. And I just found that, I found the way that you write about that sort of, like, hey, have you ever thought about it this way, to be this gentle, like hitting you over the head with a club? Because I was like, I really haven't. I really am somebody who just assumed the family is the part where people consciously decide because they came together out of this kind of a love instead of really, families are created by all the love eventually over time. Who is raising children? You can decide that in the beginning. And then as your children grow, they make some of those decisions for themselves. Mm-hmm. Who do they care about and who do they allow to influence them? I just thought it was really beautifully written and really provocative and thoughtful and much more inclusive. A way to think about maybe how to meet our needs, how to meet our emotional needs. Before we go, I wanted to tell you that I felt wildly validated by this book because, and anyone who's met me in the past year, they're like, oh, what are you working on? And I'm like, I have this idea. I would like to buy an inn. The practicality of an inn being that every bedroom already comes with a bathroom. I would like to buy an inn. I have no money to do this, by the way. It's just in my mind. I would like to buy an inn. And then I would like all the people that I care about, my extended family, to be able to use that space during the holidays and maybe a week during the summer. And the rest, I would like it to be a community space for people who are doing therapeutic things because I'm a therapist. The most important element of this is that I would have a small house. My best friend would have a small house and my sister would have a small house because I'm really tired at 50 of living far away from both of them. And I've said it so many times that it's now like a thing my husband says, it's a thing my best friend says, it's a thing that my sister says, that the communal kind of living to me is at this moment, like the largest goal that I have, that I want to be around the people that really are what your book is written about. That really are my extended family, but really the people who I adore, that I look at and think, you're the person I want to know about your day all the time. And I want you to know about my day all the time. And in therapy, we do, who are the people that adore you? And we hope those are your parents, but if they weren't your parents, who was it? Because those are the people that really they sustain us and they keep us moving. And I just thought, okay, Raina has just made the argument that I am wise beyond my years. It's not maybe the commune that we saw from the hippies, but it's a new modern structure of, hey, we would have enough bathrooms. We would probably have a big kitchen we could cook from. It's not about making money with guests. It's about being able to live in close proximity and also have some contained privacy. Yeah. And I was just thinking about it the entire time you were writing. So I'm going to give this book to so many people because I enjoyed it so much. But I also think you're saying something that hasn't been said yet, not in the way that you've said it.
Thank you. I, you know, what you're describing, the balance of privacy and communal space, is really what like the co-housing movement is all about. Yeah. And I've gotten to visit some co-housing communities, and it's really, there's a template for you to follow. You don't have to.
I don't have to invent it myself. Okay.
Yeah. Yeah.
That's good to know. And my husband is English, and there are some big buildings over there that have been turned into co-housing specifically for the elderly, but also mixed age group people living amongst each other. And there is something just really wildly compelling. This would just also include my people in child development. You may know this, they call it chumships, which is just like the magnet people, the people that you are connected to. And I just think your book is really beautiful. I can't wait to see where it goes and the conversations that it stimulates for people and maybe what it names that hasn't already been named out there.
Oh, thank you.
Thank you so much.
I touched you.
It really did. It really did. And so people who are listening to the podcast that want to know the other significant others and for any number of reasons aren't in a position to buy a book, that we buy 10 copies of a book, we will happily send it to you. So just get in touch. Just send us a DM. Everything that you need to know about Raina will be in our show notes. But Raina, do you want to tell people where to look for you next and how to find you if they are interested in knowing more about what you're writing and what you're doing?
Sure. I have a website that's just my first and last name, and I update my writing there. I work at NPR, so I mostly am doing work as a producer behind the scenes at a show called Embedded, but write here and there some longer things for The Atlantic. And yeah, you can follow me on social media, all that. One thing that's might be fine is a couple of my friends wrote a song that's based on the book that is about friendship. It's called Dear Friend. I can send it to you and you can include that in the show notes.
Oh my God, please do. That's the added bonus. Go to the show notes.
Yeah. And it is a song that you can, I think you'll feel compelled to share with your friends and you can enjoy whether or not you've read the book. But if you have read the book, that there are some elements to the song that are very specific about the book and will make it more enjoyable.
I love that because you do talk about this musical community that you're a part of. So I'm really glad to hear
I
that.
I don't even make music. Like, I just have
they're
a
making
lot of
it around
friends.
You.
Yeah.
Oh, Raina, thank you so much for this conversation. Please send me that song. I'm very excited to hear it. Congratulations on this gorgeous book. I think it's going to make a real impact in how people think about relationships in a way that really it hasn't been asked of them to think about relationships before. So I'm so grateful. And yeah, good luck on pub day and all those good things. And
thank you.
Circle back with us if there's anything that you want us to know. And otherwise, we'll let you know when this is coming out. Okay.
Great.
All right, Raina, take care. Bye-bye.
Thanks.